So on a night in April, a family was violently woken to about 20 armed agents busting through their door in the middle of the night while they slept. And in the house, there was a mum and her two daughters. And the mum said, "It was dark, all the lights were off, and my initial thoughts were that we were being robbed and that my daughters, being females, were being kidnapped." And actually, she wasn't too far off from the truth. Because ICE, which people may know is the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the Gestapo police in the United States, these agents have been going around terrorizing people across America who they suspect are undocumented immigrants. This family was actually US citizens, but none of that really mattered at all. And they were still marched out in their underwear in the dark while the ICE agents ransacked their home, seized their phones and laptops, and their life savings as evidence. Yeah, so this is the norm. And I think this is the norm because capitalism is a racist and disgusting system. Trump's attacks on migrants really drive this point home, and that it's a deliberately racist, cruel, and an inhumane treatment towards entire sections of society. And this scapegoating of migrants, is just a part of a wave, a global wave of scapegoating, particularly in Europe, and the attempt to blame them for problems created by the bosses, like the housing crisis as well here in Australia. And a pretty good example of this promotion of the pathetic, racist, anti-migrant, you might hear it, it's like March for Australia, that's been organized, yeah, shame, and promoted by, you guessed it, the far-right son of a massive property developer. So, yeah, I wonder why someone like him would want to blame migrants for a lack of affordable housing. In Queensland, another example of this is the racist lie of the youth crime epidemic. And this myth is used to whip up racist sentiment, especially around election cycles, to convince ordinary people to blame others who are worse off than them for the problems in society and to justify increased funding to violent pro-capitalist institutions like the police. And the other thing is that killing black people isn't something that just US police people do, that the US police do. Since the 1991 Royal Commission into Aboriginal deaths in custody, shamefully, over 600 Indigenous people and Torres Strait Islanders have been murdered in custody, and not a single police officer has been found guilty of these murders. Yeah. And of course, today the world is witnessing the violent genocide and the massive starvation of Palestinians. And with that comes anti-Palestinian and anti-Arab racism that's been long used by the State of Israel and its allies to support the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians and to make way for the Israeli state. And this is just a small snapshot, the picture of what capitalism looks like today. It's the racist, violent, and it's just utterly rotten to its core. So, what I'll do in this talk is basically explore how capitalism breeds racism and why this analysis is vital for the socialist strategy that can eliminate racism once and for all. And after all, it was Malcolm X who argued that you can't have capitalism without racism, that the rich and powerful both structure and benefit from this racist oppression. Now, I'm going to ask the question of what is racism, because it can seem quite obvious. You might, be able to explain it. But racism, and there's different understandings of it, can often be presented as just a problem of bad attitudes, where individuals hold racist, backwards ideas, they cling to stereotypes, and they say, offensive things and use slurs. And at best, if the racism that is built into the capitalist economy and state institutions is recognized at all, the common sense argument is that these bad attitudes are what lays the basis and cause the structural oppression that we see today. But really, if that's the case, then the way to fix it is that fix these bad attitudes is with education programs, things like training, or like training you out of your unconscious bias, or just having better conversations. But none of that really deals with the real cause of racism. And Marxists argue actually for a different way of understanding it. So we argue that racism is not just a series of bad attitudes, although obviously we recognize that people do have racist ideas and can act in a quite racist way. We say that racism is at root, a tool used by the ruling class to benefit from and maintain the system that they preside over. And capitalism, from its first days of being born, it was established through brutal colonization and conquest for the expansion of gold and silver in the expansion of European empires around the world. And Marx himself spoke about this, and he said, yeah, that's a great quote. The discovery of gold in and silver in America, the exploitation, the enslavement, and the entombment in mines of the Aboriginal population, the beginning of the conquest and looting of the East Indies, the turning of Africa into a warren for the commercial hunting of black skins, signaled the rosy dawn of the era of capitalist production. So basically, with capitalism and its birth came the most brutal, violent racism that we see. And the development of racism, the idea that some races were necessarily inferior to others and could be treated on that basis, was vital to justify both slavery and Indigenous dispossession. And that is, it developed to serve the needs of the capitalist class and to justify their rule. But it's not just historic. Bosses have continued to find it useful ever since. So Marxists start by looking at at the economic system that society is organized into to analyze the root cause and the roots of oppression and racism. Capitalism is a class-divided system. I think a lot of you would know that. A tiny minority of capitalists own and control the productive resources in society. But none of us actually who do all the work get to have any say over what happens. The working class, the majority of us, we do all our work under the watchful eye of the bosses and the managers, and we just hope that we get a decent enough wage. We don't get to have a say in what we do or what happens with our labor, and the wealth we create is not shared equally. And instead, it's the capitalists who keep the profits and give workers crumbs so we can buy the necessities to live, if barely. So that's exploitation, and all workers are exploited. Whether it's in the sweatshops in India or in the building sites in Australia, no worker is paid the full value of what their labor produces. And so, unfortunately, though, for the capitalists, it's not that easy to just get I skipped too quick to get workers on board to accept this unequal situation. So capitalist Henry Ford really expressed this kind of the woes of the parasite class when he asked, "Why is it that every time I ask for a pair of hands, they come with a brain attached?" So to keep the bosses in power, there's all these structures and of power and control that are needed to keep down the majority of people and to ensure that we're compliant. And the violent structures of the state, all the cops, the armies, the prisons, and the legal systems, and so on, they're essential weapons for the bosses, but there are other tools they use as well every day. And so, for workers to accept their position in the workplace and in society, certain conditions and ideas are useful to the bosses to ensure our subordination and to reinforce workers' obedience. And so, Marxists argue that all forms of oppression, from racism to sexism and to many more, they are all fundamentally connected. And they are all, because they are all tools of the ruling class to subjugate the majority of humanity. And so that means all workers are oppressed, no matter their race, their gender, their religion, etc. Whether it's in the third world, or here in Australia, workers are first and foremost oppressed as workers. But that's, of course, not to discount the fact that there are different sections of workers who face worse conditions and worse, or endure discrimination based on other aspects of their lives and identities. And the oppression of the working class from the degrading, or even the dangerous conditions of the workplace to the constant undermining of working class people, the creating of feelings of powerlessness. Just think of your jobs having to meet KPIs, meeting your daily sales, and how quickly you have to dish out, an order. And even being forced to smile at your abusive customers, all of this has always been a feature of capitalism. But bosses are not just content with oppressing us simply as the working class. Bosses have an interest in eroding workers' conditions, always wanting to drive down our wages and pushing production to the extreme just to maximize profitability. And one of the ways they do this is by sowing divisions within the working class. And so racism, that's where it comes into play. Sections of the working class are discriminated against, not just in ideas about their supposed inferiority. The bosses also use these oppressive ideas in a whole series of ways that are structured into the way that capitalism works. So an individual racist is not the cause of this structural racism. So whether it's low pay, relegation to doing shitty or dangerous jobs, or sometimes being shut out from the workplace entirely, that's all useful for the bosses to do, and racism helps them to do that. But also, I want to say that racist oppression under capitalism is not just like limited to the workplace or numbers on a balance sheet. The bosses proactively pit local workers against foreign ones, which is about just weakening the whole working class as a whole. And a divided working class means bosses are let off the hook for workers' shitty pay and conditions, but also for all sorts of social ills and problems, from the lack of housing to crime. They use migrants as scapegoats for society's problems, and that's an important function of racism for actually the majority of capitalist nations across the world. And so racism today exists in every country, and I think that's an important point to make, because often racism is pitched as white majority countries against non-white countries, which are usually seen in the global south. This is wrong. Racism is a class question. Racism is a key oppression that all ruling classes use. So in India, for example, a country that was brutally and historically been under British occupation, under racist British occupation, anti-Muslim racism is a key feature of Indian politics today. And the Modi government heads one of the world's biggest fascist movements. So the theory of white supremacist countries opposed to non-white countries doesn't really hold up as the root cause of racism. And I think this explanation. So this explanation that I've laid out is quite different to the common sense ideas about what racism is. But what all of those other explanations really have in common is that they root oppression in the behavior of that's just, you know, these innate qualities of individuals. When actually, instead, the reality and the persistence of racism points to the ruling class and the capitalist system they preside over. Sorry, I'm just going to do that. A bit loud. Is that fine? Yep. Okay. Yeah, the reality is, and the persistence of racism, the cause of that is the ruling class and the capitalist system that they preside over. And that's the root cause of racial oppression. It's something that is embedded in all of the major structures of capitalist society, from our schools to businesses to prisons to sport, even creating systematic disadvantage for the racially oppressed. So, actually, another way that racism plays out is that capitalism creates just an endless cycle of war. So capitalism is a system that adapts and changes based on what suits the interests of the ruling class at any point in time, just in order to maximize profits. And the competition between them not only means that they want to screw over the working class people that they themselves employ, but sometimes going to war, to increase the profits, their profits at the expense of the capitalists of other nations. And so racism has been used as a tool in the service of this imperialist competition. They whip up racism to justify wars and to get workers to fight for them. So, you know, think of the lie about liberating women in 2001, in Afghanistan, for example, or to justify the cruel treatment of refugees, after the wars that you've created. And this also helps explain that the idea of racism isn't just this bad characteristic of individuals, you know, like this just shows you that it's not just about bad individuals who just have these racist ideas. Racism has changed targets under capitalism. And so when the Western governments were led by the US, wanted to control the Middle East and expand their imperialist control of the region, they used Islamophobia to justify the invasion of Afghanistan and then Iraq. And then, you know, but actually think back to a long time ago. So anti-Irish racism was actually a key feature of Australian politics for almost 200 years. And it came from the oppression of Ireland as a colony of Britain and was brought over to Australia on the First Fleet. And it was the main racism and kind of racial and communal division amongst working class people for much of this entire period. But today, Irish people or those with an Irish background don't really experience racism on that basis at all. Okay, so explain kind of where racism comes from as the root and its kind of roots in the economic system. So what does liberation look like and how do we actually fight racism? I want to start with what liberation is not. And so most people on the left already know that black faces in high places is meaningless. I think none of us here would look to Barack Obama as progressive. His nickname while he was in office was called the Deporter in Chief, and that's because he deported more immigrants than all the US presidents before him combined. Yeah. And we know under his presidency, Black Lives Matter emerged. That's because, you know, having a black president doesn't stop police brutality or the murder of black people in America. And so if representation was the answer, the lives of black Americans would have improved under him. And instead, you had the same cops, the same system and the same prisons, just with a different face. And it's not obviously not just Obama. Having more black cops or CEOs or politicians hasn't really changed the system at all. And so representation without changing class society just actually now means that people of color now get to join in the exclusive club of being oppressors. And it's really just window dressing for the same old exploitation. And I think if you're a left-wing person and if you're radical, you know that, yeah, there's very obvious limitation to these sorts of politics. But actually there is a more radical sounding versions of this idea that people still hold on to or cling to, which is the claim that we should just follow the lead of the oppressed. So as if every oppressed person automatically knows the right way forward to fight against oppression. But this is really actually quite nonsense because oppressed people don't all agree. They don't all have the same ideas. And to assume that they do is kind of racist in itself. So if we look at this, if we look at, like, I'll use the voice referendum, which is a recent example of this. Indigenous people were divided on it. Do you vote yes or do you vote no? And some people did campaign for yes and some people campaigned for no. And the racist no campaign, which was obviously a racist campaign, was led by Jacinta Price and Warren Mundine, both Indigenous, both openly peddling anti-Indigenous racism and garbage, and they both were lining up with the far right. And you can see, like, who is the person standing over the shoulder of Jacinta Price, known rabid, disgusting racist Peter Dutton. So their identity didn't actually magically stop them from siding with the racists. So if you have the politics or the principles of just follow what the oppressed are doing, well, which oppressed person are you going to follow? Like, are you going to look to these people? And I think this shows the problem that identity and experience alone don't give you the full picture. Of course, experience can radicalize, but it can also push people to having reactionary conclusions. Some say that the solution to racist policing is that we need more black cops. Others rightfully say that the police should be abolished. And so very, you know, same experience, but actually different politics and conclusions. And another popular idea is the privilege, kind of understanding that there's privilege in society. It's just a kind of framework of ideas. And you might have heard it. I think you have. White people benefit from racism, and what they need to do to challenge racism is to check their privilege. But I think, again, this is wrong because racism doesn't actually benefit ordinary white workers. It weakens overall the working class movement, and that includes white people. So when migrants are underpaid, be it here in Australia or in America, it's not the white workers that get to pocket the difference. It's the bosses that do. And really, racism has been used to keep wages down and divide workers, so we can't really fight back. And that doesn't really help any worker, be it black, white, Hispanic, migrant, or not migrant. And honestly, the other thing that I really hate about this kind of way of talking about privileges is what are we actually calling privileges? Like having a job, being able to go to the doctor, or not getting evicted. These aren't privileges, they're basic rights. And the problem isn't that some workers have too much. It's actually that most of us have too little. And socialists shouldn't go around telling people or workers that they should give something up. Our job is to argue to people that everyone deserves decent healthcare, housing, education, and wages. And the reason that we don't, it's because it's the bosses who hoard all the wealth. And so the whole tick your privilege stuff really is just a guilt trip for ordinary people. While the real privilege, which I think no one talks about, the real privilege that exists in society is the billionaires, it's the politicians, it's the bosses. They just sit back and laugh at us. They're not checking anything except their bank balance. And so that's actually the only privilege, the privilege of being in the ruling class that really matters in the system. The privilege of the ruling class of every race, of every color who profit off our exploitation. And it's not really in the interest of any worker of any color, to not challenge this system. Okay. So what do we argue instead? So instead of identity politics or privilege theory, socialists argue for solidarity amongst the oppressed. And in particular, we argue that the potential power of the working class is key in overcoming racism. And of course, we are all different. We experience the world differently, and we're subjected to different forms of oppression. And different forms of oppression, however, don't exist by themselves or independently of each other. So as I explained at the beginning, racism and all forms of oppression arise from and are all useful to the same economic system and the capitalist class who rule it. So we need to fight it collectively. And so, like the old union saying goes, united we stand, divided we fall. And so the working class contains all of the oppressed in society, and we all have the common enemy of the bosses. And our experience of being workers exploited by a boss is what we can use to unite workers to fight for the sake of our own interests. And that is the unity and the solidarity that we should place emphasis on. And the other thing is that resistance and protest movements and strikes, so through these is it's the only way that actually oppressed groups have made any gains and have fought back throughout history. Battles for dignity and rights under capitalism can build the confidence of the downtrodden. It can spark organization and open up people to questioning the very foundations of the society that it's built on. And socialism, and smashing capitalism, that can only come through a revolution. And that is a task that that only the working class can undertake. And that's just the case for two reasons. So first, the ruling class will never give up their power willingly. They will never give up their property, and they'll never give up their privilege. We look to the working class not as suffering victims, but as agents of social change because of their position in relation to production, and they produce all the wealth in society. And so, resistance by separate oppressed groups is powerful. It can cause disruption. It can change public opinion and actually inspire other groups to rebel. But these actions can remain marginal if they're not broadened. And a recent example of this is the Black Lives Matter movements in 2020. So they were mass, they were radical, and they swept the US. And, there was a resonance of them all across the world and in many countries, including here. And people at the height of the protests were talking about reforming, defunding, or just actually abolishing the police altogether. And the burning of the Minneapolis police station was supported by the majority of Americans. Yeah. And so the mass movement saw the very rare arrest of the killer cop. And it was definitely a victory for the movement. But if you fast forward to the end of the year, the protests were wound up, and the main demands of the movement, which was namely diverting resources from police to other services, were not met. And so the change was apparently going to come by electing Biden. And of course, we know what a disgusting racist Biden is and how he wants to obviously maintain capitalism. So ultimately, to win, it's when those mass movements are combined with working class resistance that we can stop the boss's profits through strikes and other industrial actions. That's when these mass movements can actually become the most powerful. And for a strike to be successful, all sections of workers, no matter their background, have to be united behind it. Capitalists just can't continue to run their system if the workers refuse to work for them. And so this means that workers have the potential power to overthrow the ruling class and collectively take over production to meet human needs. So that's the first reason why we need a revolution. And the second reason is that only in revolution can the class, and as Marx says, succeed in ridding itself of all the muck of ages and become fitted to found society anew. And I think this is really important because we're not so naive to assume that the attitudes of people will simply just change through education, as liberals think. It's actually no surprise that workers adopt and are influenced by the bigotry promoted by our rulers. Oh, thank you. And the material reality of just the oppression of the system. And Marx acknowledged that mostly workers are just dominated by capitalist ideas, and that the alteration of the people on a mass scale is necessary, as Marx puts it himself. But the point of that is that ideas can actually change. And throughout history, the history of capitalism, mass rebellions and revolutions have shown us how this change occurs. So in 2019, the much-hated dictator of Sudan was being challenged by masses in that country. And one way that the regime tried to save itself was to sow division and hatred towards Darfurians, which were an ethnic group who had been massacred by the regime previously, and basically blaming the uprising on them. And a response to this was that the protesters chanted, "Hey, you arrogant racist, we are all Darfur." So, but even short of revolutions, high points of struggle have seen workers just join up with the oppressed. So in 1946, Aboriginal pastoral workers in the Pilbara region of Western Australia went on strike for better wages and conditions, and they faced vicious repression from police and employers. But they also crucially won solidarity from non-Aboriginal unionists. And they were led by socialists and communists. Unions raised funds and publicized their struggle. And most importantly, understanding that they had a common enemy in the capitalists, they won their fellow unionists to using their collective power in solidarity with Aboriginal strikes. And they won when workers on the Perth waterfront refused to load anything from the scab station that they were trying to un that was trying to undermine the Pilbara strike. And that's the, you know, that solidarity didn't end or eradicate racism overnight, but it showed that workers in struggle can defy the divisions and the system that the system tries to impose on them. And this was in 1946. And so this year as well, despite a worldwide ruling class campaign to disgracefully support Israel, dock workers in Greece, in France, and in Italy have taken strike action in support of Palestine. And I talked about this in opening night. In Greece, they refused to unload a shipment of weapon-grade steel from the Ever Golden, which is an Israeli ship, I think. Yeah. And so the workers said, "The dock workers of Piraeus will not be complicit. We will not unload military steel from the Ever Golden. No to Greece's involvement. Freedom for Palestine." Yeah. So that's the power that socialists look to challenging oppression. And during the high points of struggle and revolutions, workers finally get to take control and be the commanders of their own lives. And the Russian revolutionary Vladimir Lenin observed this process as, and he says, "The masses who have often been ignored and been and even despised by superficial observers are learning in practice, taking their first tentative steps, feeling their ways, defining their objectives, testing themselves and the theories of all their ideologists. Okay, so to sum up, Marxists aren't naive to think that revolution will abolish oppression overnight, but that's because revolutions, you know, themselves don't happen overnight. Revolutions are a battle fought in every area of life, and they are an extended process of mass politicizations of workers by the struggle itself. And so the very process of fighting back brings workers into conflict with the ideas and the structures that underpin oppression, the oppression such as racism. And so for workers to win, they have to overcome these structures. And not everyone has the same interest in destroying the capitalist structure's root and branch. And the dominant political currents, such as the Labour Party and the Greens, are committed to running capitalism in some way or another, rather than overthrowing it. And under capitalism, we can and we should and have to push to challenge and alleviate racism. But while capitalism continues to exist, and struggle can recede, and that just allows the ruling class to reassert its authority, and it leaves the problems of society unsolved. And that's because racism serves the interests of capitalism, and it's built into its every structures. It's only in a socialist society, when the working class abolishes the exploitative economic system, that we can get rid of oppression once and for all. And so socialists, for that reason, argue that the movement we need today has to be radical, doesn't compromise through half measures, trying to placate the rich or find halfway solutions that keeps capitalism intact. We want to push the struggle as far as it can go. And today we struggle for reforms to push back against racism in the here and now, but our aim is a revolution, and we have to start building that from today, because that's the only way we're going to smash oppression. And so that means being a dedicated activist and building the revolutionary left well before any struggle breaks out, so we can make sure that our side wins.